Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 8 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for spring pre-registration is April 21st. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll talk with IPR's Clay Masters. He'll help us remember Bill Stowe, the Des Moines Waterworks CEO, who died last Sunday. To start off our hour, let's talk with Caroline Cummings, Iowa State House politics reporter for the Sinclair Broadcast Group's Iowa stations. Caroline, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Let's talk a little bit, if you could, run us through some of the highlights this week at the State House, starting off with the governor signing bills, making some big changes to Iowa's mental health system. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so the Iowa Senate gave the okay for her mental health proposal, which has been a top priority for her. It comes on the heels of legislation expanded last year to expand services for the adult system, and it would task the 14 county regions that oversee the adult system to implement certain services for children, including a 24-hour crisis hotline for parents in need and crisis residential treatment options. The goal is to provide mental health care for all children in Iowa, regardless of where they live and economic background. And some Democrats were weary about a sustainable funding source to keep the services up and running. But that is going to be an ongoing discussion, Republicans say. And it also codifies a state board the governor established that would oversee the system and continue to study the issue. So they've long said it's kind of just the beginning of this process, and the governor is slated to have a ceremony signing that bill into law very soon.
Mm-hmm. We've reported on industrial hemp. The fact in the last farm bill, the federal government eased restrictions. States are acting on this easing of the restrictions. Talk a little bit about what's happening here in the Iowa State House concerning hemp.
Yeah, so like you said, the Farm Bill made it possible for states to expand production of hemp. Iowa was one of just a handful of states that didn't have any laws on the books related to hemp production or research of hemp already. So this is a big step forward, and it's gotten basically nearly sweeping bipartisan support. I mean, in the Senate, it passed 49-1, and it would authorize the production, the process, the marketing of industrial hemp in Iowa, which hemp can be used for a number of things, including fabric and paper and biofuels. So supporters have contended that this is a great way to add a new cash crop to the market, especially in times where, you know, farmers are struggling because of tariffs and commodity prices dropping. So the bill was approved, like I said, with nearly full support from both Democrats and Republicans. Mm-hmm. And the bill would limit 40 acres per farmer to start. And that idea is that so, you know, these big companies don't come in and just buy up all the land. It's the idea is so, you know, small farmers can benefit from this legislation. And the idea is that it would probably start production in the 2020 season.
Okay, so when we're driving our highways and interstates along in Iowa, we can look out for hemp fields, perhaps. So learn to recognize them at least starting in 2020. Let's talk about sports betting. The Iowa Senate, I understand, passed a sports betting bill. What would this bill change, Caroline?
So for the first time ever, it will legalize sports gambling in Iowa. So Iowans could go to one of the state's 19 casinos and place bets on collegiate and professional sports games, and also through a mobile app that will be regulated by this commission that runs the casino. So for the first time ever, it'll be legalized, and that was made possible because a U.S. Supreme Court decision last year said, hey, states have the authority to legalize this if they want to. So supporters have long said that this is already going on, so we might as well regulate it and tax it and bring it, quote, out of the dark. So one unique thing is that you can't make in-game bets on players' performances. So if X player is playing during an Iowa State game versus the University of Kentucky, you can't place a bet on if they're going to make a three-pointer mid-game. Mm. So that's one thing that's interesting carved out of that. But overall, it would allow you to bet on the outcomes of professional and college games.
Of course, Iowans still dealing mostly in western Iowa with catastrophic flooding. The governor addressing that this week as well. How?
So she signed an executive order establishing a flood advisory board that will continue to coordinate comprehensive recovery and rebuilding efforts going forward. But in the meantime, she teamed up with state house leaders to announce a $15 million funding package for flood relief for this budget year, which ends June 30th, in addition to another $10 million that lawmakers will work into the 2020 fiscal year budget, which they're working out right now. The idea is that because FEMA and other federal funds can sometimes take a while to really kick in, lawmakers and the governor think it's prudent to do something at the state level to give Iowans some relief more quickly.
Mm-hmm. And finally, something here, a development there that I hadn't heard of before, but to tell us about it, a bill that involves stun guns on community college and Regent University campuses.
So this is actually a very fascinating issue because the idea was actually brought forth by a constituent in Senate President Charles Schneider's district. He has daughters and talked about them being on campus and wanting them to have a safety measure, if you will, in place. And so he pitched the idea of allowing stun guns. So right now, under Iowa law, Iowans over the age of 18 are allowed to carry stun guns, but some colleges have written rules that would bar them from campus. So this basically says Regents universities and community colleges can't ban stun guns, so the idea is that supporters say it's the safety measure in place just to give an added layer of protection, especially when there's alarming rates of sexual assaults reported on campus. And so that will be allowed under Iowa law if this, of course, passes the Senate and the governor signs it into law. And also one key thing is there was an amendment adopted that would exclude people with felony convictions from this law if it takes effect.
Okay, Caroline Cummings, thank you so much for giving us some highlights this past week at the Iowa State House. Caroline Cummings, State House and politics reporter for the Sinclair Broadcast Group's Iowa stations. Caroline, you take care and have a great weekend.
Thank you, Ben. You too.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's talk about what's been happening to some people who live in mobile homes in the state. Two mobile home communities here in Iowa have experienced some sudden, really dramatic increases in rent. Rent increases of more than 50%. And the company behind these sharp rent hikes has just purchased two more parks in the state. Here to tell us, hopefully, what's going on, Zachary Oren Smith. He's a reporter, the city reporter for the Iowa City Press Citizen. Zachary, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Ben.
Before we get into your reporting, it's very interesting because I think it'll be new to a lot of our listeners what's happening. A lot of our listeners don't live in mobile home parks. So what are the basics for how you pay for and rent in a mobile home park?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. Thanks again for having me to the show. The basics that you need to know about are these lots are rented, right? You don't own the land that your house is on. Sometimes people will rent to buy the mobile homes that they'll set on these lands, but as opposed to a site-built house, what maybe your listeners may be more familiar with, a mobile home is moved onto a plot of land in one of these parks, and the tenant of that plot of land can eventually own that the actual house on the plot of land, the plot remains rented by the park, right?
Okay, so with that in mind, tell us what has been happening with these rent increases. North Liberty, Waukee, or those are the two places we're talking about, mobile home parks there.
Yeah, so in late March, the residents of North Liberty's Gulfview Mobile Home Park received a notice on their doors that the ownership had changed. The former owners had sold to a Utah-based private real estate company called Haven Park Capital, and as part of the Haven Park Capital felt that the rent prices were lower than what is market value. And they decided that they were going to do one large increase in North Liberty by raising the rent as by 58%.
58%.
That's right.
Okay, and what's sort of an average of what you might pay for rent?
Before with rent and utilities, one of the residents of North Liberty's park that I talked to, Don Lund, explained that he was paying approximately $500.
That's
a month.
Before.
That was before.
How did this company, Haven Park Capital, justify these increases?
Well, Johnson County is a high-growth area, right? You also mentioned the property in Waukee. That's Midwest County Estates, which received a 69% increase. These are two locations in some of the few growing counties in the United States, not just the state of Iowa. Property values are rising. I mean, I think here in Johnson County, I think a lot of my sources have been complaining about some pretty significant property tax increases in the city and in the county. I do want to say that I worry that there's some finger pointing at Haven Park Capital. I would say that this is a trend that you're seeing across the United States. I was talking to an organizer in a park in New York State that they've actually gotten to the point where they're withholding some of the 60% of the residents were withholding rent as a means of trying to collectively bargain against a similarly severe rent increase.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how did the residents react? Are the residents able to stay? Does this drive some of them out? What are their reactions when you spoke with them?
So I think it's important to remember that, a lot of people might prefer to live in a site-built home, right? Manufactured housing may not be the ideal solution to housing, but it is nonetheless in the United States an important, affordable source.
And it's a lot lower cost.
It's a lot lower cost for seniors on fixed income, for folks on disability, for low-income families. You know, these are opportunities for housing that just don't exist elsewhere, and especially in these high-growth areas where there are jobs. Right, where the job growth, we are seeing a lot of our job growth. Sometimes these sites are the opportunity for housing. And when a one-time increase of 58 or 69% occurs, that just limits that limits choices, that limits opportunity for some of these families, some mm-hmm. of these individuals.
Mm-hmm. Okay, did you talk with some of the people who had experienced these rent increases?
When a source first sent me the letter that Haven Park Capital had sent out, I went. My first instinct is to go door knocking. That's where I met Don Lund and got to know a little bit about his story. He was born without hands and feet and is a man who's on disability. He had just gotten out of debt after having paid down his house. I mean, he's been kind of living the life in this plot. And this rate increase is going to mean that Don is going to face some tough choices. Maybe that means a roommate, mm-hmm. but moving that house may not be an opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Have you talked with these companies, Haven Park Capital? Did you get in touch with them for a comment?
Yeah, me and my colleague at the Des Moines Register, Ian Richardson, we've been working to try to get with Haven Park Capital. While we've received sort of statements on the individual purchases, we've not been able to get time with them. Mm-hmm. But we're very open to it. I mean, again, I don't think this is particular to Haven Park Capital. This is a trend in the United States. We just want to know more.
And you reported that some of our elected officials have taken an interest in this, in particular the U.S. Representative in Congress, Dave Loebsack of the 2nd District, also State Senator Zach Walls voicing their concerns about this. Let me just read what Dave Loebsack said about this. He said, "I am gravely concerned about these reports of your threat to raise rents on my constituents. Mobile home parks provide affordable housing in our community, and many of the folks living in these parks cannot afford a sudden and unexpected rent increase like the one you propose." And this is speaking of the North Liberty's Gulfview mobile home court. So talk a little bit more how elected officials have stepped in and what they could possibly do.
Right. So you mentioned Representative Loebsack, you mentioned State Senator Zach Walls. There's also State Senator Kevin Kenney, who's also been involved in the conversation that we had earlier this week at the Capitol. I also reached out to Senator Grassley's office and had got back the statement that, and I quote, "Because of the limited role the federal government has on these issues, Senator Grassley encourages Iowans to contact state representation."
So, Zachary, going forward, what will you be watching in your reporting here on this story?
Right now, I'm really interested in Haven Park Capital and any other properties that get that become acquired by Capital. But I'm also interested in other companies, right? I mean, Havenpark Capital is a relatively new player and is certainly not the largest. Groups like Yes Communities, which makes up a much larger share of the market in terms of these owners of these parks. You know, I'm more interested in how all of these actors working together in our state impact homeowners' ability to find affordable housing here in Iowa.
Okay. Thank you very much, Zachary Oren Smith, city reporter with the Iowa City Press Citizen. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for your interest in the story.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Wednesday of this week, hundreds attended a funeral for Bill Stowe. Now, many Iowans will remember Stowe for his work fighting for clean water in the state in recent years. He spent his career as a public servant. He was the Des Moines Public Works Director for 13 years. That was before taking on the role of Des Moines Water Works CEO in 2012. And he stayed in that post until illness forced him to retire on April 2nd. Stowe died last Sunday from pancreatic cancer. He was 60 years old. For some reflections on Bill Stowe as a person and his legacy as a dedicated public servant, let me turn to my colleague, IPR's Clay Masters, who interviewed him several times over the course of the last few years. And Clay, I understand you got to know him quite well.
Yeah, Bill Stowe, my first interaction with him, I got here in 2012, and that was around the time of the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy coming out, which laid out a lot of voluntary efforts that the state wanted farmers to do to cut down on pollution coming out of farms through drainage tiles. And Bill Stowe was the newly hired director, the executive director, general manager, CEO of the Des Moines Water Works. And I was seeking some comment about this nutrient reduction strategy, thought it'd be good to talk to somebody from a municipality about the regulations that they were asking farmers to do voluntarily. And I interviewed Bill Stowe, had never met him before, and I was floored by the kind of response that I got. This wasn't a normal reaction. You know, a lot of times somebody in this position tries to walk that line of, you know, speaking against something but still showing support. But he was, it was obvious from that very first time I interviewed him that he was going to be somebody that was pushing back against agribusiness and large-scale agriculture in the state.
Right. And this eventually led to the utility filing a clean water suit in 2015. Remind us quickly how that came about and what the outcome was.
Yeah, the lawsuit, which Bill actually came into our studios in Des Moines the morning after the board of the Des Moines Water Works decided they were going to sue Buena Vista, Sac, and Calhoun counties for drainage districts that were a non-point polluter, which means, you know, it's not coming from a pipe. They were suing these drainage districts in these counties, which, you know, went on for years. This lawsuit really opened a discussion that was taking place in quiet corners of the state, which is how Art Cullen, the Storm Lake Times editor, put it in a recent editorial. And so it just, you know, farmers were up in arms about it. And, you know, Art Cullen, I mentioned him, he wrote a recent editorial after Bill Stowe was came out and saying that he had this pancreatic cancer, fast-acting cancer, and said that it took courage to start the conversation. These are Art's words, with honesty and professional dignity, which was not always reciprocated. He said it takes courage for Stowe to continue urging for the cause of clean water and healthy agriculture as he considers his own destiny. Each of us should admire that and engage in a vigorous but respectful debate as Bill Stowe has. It can't be put back in the bottle now, were Cullen's words, kind of summing up his legacy.
Right. And Clay, I understand you have a bit of audio from your last conversation with Bill Stowe. Give us a sense, play it, and give us a sense of how articulate, how passionate this man was about the welfare of us all and clean water.
Yeah, the last conversation I had with him was in 2017 for a story I was doing about kind of life after the lawsuit, if you will. So the Supreme Court basically said you can't sue drainage districts. You can look it up for the direct legalese there. But I was doing a story basically like, what are next steps after this lawsuit has been thrown out? And at the end of the conversation, I just kind of asked Bill to talk about what the future was going to hold for Iowa in regards to clean water. And here's what he said.
We as Iowans have fallen into this trap that we're a sacrifice state for industrial agriculture, that living here means that we shouldn't have recreational surface water use. Well, that's ridiculous. We have every right to have recreational surface water use and should continue to advocate for it. Now it's reached a point where we think there are public health consequences from that as drinking water providers.
So that was from 2017, Clay, your conversation with Bill Stowe. Bill Stowe, survived by his wife of over 30 years, also his son, Liam. You were at the funeral on Wednesday at his home parish, St. Anthony Catholic Church. Tell us what the scene was like there.
Well, you know, he was the public works director for Des Moines for 13 years, and I wasn't here during that time period, but, you know, people say that he was on TV a lot anytime that there was any kind of flooding going on in the Des Moines area, or if the roads were going to start to need to be cleared for snow. He was a public figure, and the public turned out. The city turned out. There were police officers in uniform. There was the mayor, Frank County. State lawmakers from the Des Moines area, both Democratic and Republican, were among those gathered. And it was just a reminder that this is a guy who a lot of times I was talking to because of his role in a state issue, but he was very much a figure in the city of Des Moines.
At the funeral and otherwise, Clay, leave us with a little more of a sense of what Bill Stowe was like as a person.
Yeah, the person officiating the funeral talked about his faith. He was a regular at St. Anthony's Saturday evening mass. He said he would read scripture, talked about the devotion he had to his wife and his son, Liam. He called him his, you know, great pride. And he also mentioned something about the Des Moines Register referring to him regularly as looking like Russell Crowe, the actor, and saying that it made sense because the man officiating the funeral said he was a fighter, whether it was over water or roads. He was putting forth a good fight of life. And on the back of the program, if you flipped it over, there were the lyrics to the Lynyrd Skynyrd song Freebird. Stowe was also a motorcycle driver as well.
On the back of the funeral program. We'll leave it there and go into this break with a little of that, I think, Clay. Clay Masters, thank you so much for helping us to remember Bill Stowe, who died this past Sunday. His funeral was held this week on Wednesday. Thanks, Clay.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
After a short break, IPR's Grant Gerlach will be with us. He'll talk about Iowa's immigrant workforce. Also, rural food deserts. Right here in Iowa, we'll find out what food deserts are. If you don't know what they are, we'll find out. Talk about that. Plenty to come. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a minute.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 8 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for spring pre-registration is April 21st. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
And we are back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In response to the southern border crisis with the increasing flood of asylum seekers from Latin America. You may recall how recently President Trump said our country is full, that there's no room for more migrants. But some Midwest employers disagree. They say they need many more immigrants to fill empty jobs. Grant Gerlach of Iowa Public Radio, he's our Central Iowa reporter, joins me now. Hi, Grant.
Good to be back today.
Good to have you on in our studio. You've been looking into this, done quite a bit of reporting on it. First of all, I wonder, give us a picture of Iowa's labor market and how migrant workers fit in.
Okay, well, Iowa has a labor market where there are quite a few open jobs and generally speaking, not enough people to fill them all. We're short when it comes to workers.
Okay, what types of jobs?
Well, it's kind of a wide range in different skill levels. Probably the greatest need is for lower skilled workers to work in agriculture, for instance, in livestock facilities, concentrated livestock facilities, in meat packing plants or meat processing facilities. Those take a lot of people. There's still a lot of manual labor involved with those jobs. And so that's an area where they're needed, and especially because they're in rural areas, and there's also an especial shortage of workers in those parts of the state. It also includes the construction industry. A lot of immigrant workers in the construction industry, they need more people. The restaurant industry is another one where they use many immigrant workers. It's often a first job for someone who comes to the U.S. to work in a kitchen or to bus tables, to do that kind of thing, the kind of restaurant work where you don't have to speak English. And so those are a few industries that are sort of closer to the top of the list.
Mm-hmm. I just mentioned the president's quote from a few days ago. You've spoken with migrant workers and also with those who need this type of work. What are their voices saying in particular? Who did you speak with?
Yeah, well, I spoke to a woman in Mount Pleasant, and her husband was one of the workers detained in an immigration raid very close to a year ago at the concrete plant in Mount Pleasant. They make precast concrete parts. And he was in jail for several months. He applied for asylum while he was in custody, but was denied. And then last month, he was deported back to his native Honduras. And he applied for asylum because he was afraid of the violent situation there. And in fact, the last time she heard from him was a few weeks ago after he landed back in Honduras. And since then, she has not spoken to him personally. She's spoken to his family and was told about an incident where some guys came to the house. They think a local gang. They wanted to see him. They think they wanted to shake him down for money. And frankly, what happened is a little unclear, and she's afraid for his life at this point.
Mm-hmm. Iowa has a relatively low unemployment rate at the moment. What is it, under
3%? 2.4%.
So without these immigrant workers, what does our agriculture, food services, the things that you listed, what does it look like in Iowa without that migrant labor?
Well, the work that's there still gets done, but what it does is slow down growth. So, for instance, in the restaurant industry, let's say you want to open a new location, you have to have staff. You have to have staff in the kitchen. You have to have staff in the front of the house, too. You need all those workers to be lined up before you can open. Mm-hmm. But one restaurant group that I talked to said they have about sometimes half the workers they need already. So that makes it really tough to look at opening a new location somewhere if you're not sure you're going to have all the people you need. And the same could go for the agriculture industry, too. Are you going to have the people you need to be on the line, in the barns, and what have you? So it's a lag, whether you're talking about immigrant workers or just other workers from around the state, when there aren't enough people to fill those jobs, it's a drag on the economic growth. It doesn't mean there isn't economic growth, but it could be faster if there were more people to fill those jobs and increase productivity.
Mm-hmm. And Iowa, of course, is not the only state experiencing the similar trends and the needs that you've just described.
Lots of states in the Midwest. There's very low unemployment in like New Hampshire, Vermont. Those are also states that are top of the list.
Mm-hmm.
You can notice that those are also fairly rural states as well.
Right.
A lot of states are encountering this kind of shortage.
So what have leaders in our state said about this? For instance, you would think the Secretary of Agriculture, senators would be interested in this.
Well, farm groups have been calling for reform around the visa programs for a long time. Obviously, we know that the immigration debate hasn't gotten that far in Congress when it comes to developing actual proposals. Just so much of the debate focuses on the wall and how to deal with the sort of imminent situation when it comes to migrant groups coming to the border. In Iowa, there was an E-Verify bill that was proposed to require basically all businesses to use E-Verify, and a lot of companies didn't want to do that, not because they don't believe in, you know, following the law when it comes to hiring workers, but because there's, you know, there's more paperwork involved with that kind of thing. And it could, even people who are have documents may be less likely to apply for jobs. It's just a very... People feel very vulnerable when it comes to their status in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. I want to mention also in connection with this, back to some more of the president's words on sanctuary cities, putting those back in the headlines. Donald Trump has threatened to relocate undocumented immigrants, asylum seekers to these so-called sanctuary cities. We're understanding from the NPR coverage that these are generally the America's largest metropolitan areas, Chicago, close to us, but also Seattle and so forth. I wonder, do any of Iowa's cities, I don't think they do, actually call themselves sanctuary cities?
I couldn't tell you that directly, but what I did hear is that Iowa is not generally a first stop for people coming into the U.S., whether they're immigrants or refugees. Oftentimes, they're relocated to another spot, and then they come to Iowa when they hear about certain opportunities, work opportunities. So that's how a lot of people end up coming to Iowa, is because they hear about open jobs and are looking for their chance to find some work in the U.S.
Okay. Grant Gerlach, thanks for coming into the studio for a few minutes, and we'll listen to your reports later in the day on All Things Considered. IPR Central Iowa reporter Grant Gerlach.
Thanks.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Iowa town of Jessup is just east of Waterloo. It has about 2,500 residents. But what it may not have in the very near future is a grocery store. Jessup's only grocery store is planning to close next month. The owners of Jessup Food Center are currently selling off inventory, and they have plans to shut down operations sometime in May. Joining us to talk about the situation in Jessup, but more broadly, the picture of so-called food deserts here in Iowa, Jennifer Swaggerman is Associate Director of the Drake Agricultural Law Center in Des Moines. Jennifer, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me today.
Wanted to have you back on because we heard that you recently led a seminar on these rural food deserts at a food policy conference at Georgetown University. Let's pick up where I just started, Jessup here, because this is not, I understand, sort of an isolated trend. What's happening in Jessup as part of a larger trend?
Well, unfortunately, it's something we've seen going on for well over a decade now, in that it's getting harder and harder for smaller communities. Those under, I think, roughly about 3,800 people is what they have said are needed to really sustain a grocery store long-term in a community. And as we continue to see rural populations decline, it is harder to support and sustain the volume necessary for successful grocery stores in those areas.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you have any statistics on how many towns are being affected of this size, the 3,000 and less inhabitants?
Well, none of the statistics that I have are extremely recent, but just one example is that if you looked between 1995 and 2005, mm-hmm. we went from about 1,400 grocery stores to just over 700 in Iowa. But yet we saw the super centers expand by almost 200% in that same time period, meaning that it was the smaller stores, the smaller communities that were losing about half their stores. And just in towns under 1,000 people in that same time period, those towns lost 43% of their grocery stores in that time.
So when I look at a map, and we would kind of like look at this, make a graphic to look at it. So you're saying these super centers, like a Walmart super center with a large grocery store on it, comes in, and they need a large area to draw from to make it worth their while. And they plan these out very, very well across the country. And then it sort of saps the ability for these smaller grocery stores to exist?
It does. They pull from a larger area. And the other challenge is that thinking about rural development in just a broader sphere is that a lot of people are leaving their rural communities for work. They may travel to one of those more urban centers during the day for employment and do their grocery shopping there. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's convenience. Sometimes it's because there are more choices at the larger stores. Other times it's price. But again, it raises a challenge for those smaller stores.
Mm-hmm. So we mentioned food deserts. That may be a term that not everyone is aware of. What is a food desert?
A food desert is considered an area in which you have limited access to a food source. So in an urban area, that's considered 1 mile from a food source with reliable transportation. In a rural area, it's 10 miles. And so if you just think about our communities, that's a pretty broad part of Iowa.
Mm-hmm. So when we have a community that loses its only grocery store, then you would have convenience stores filling in the gap. But convenience stores do not have all the options, right?
That's very true. When you lose the grocery store in a community or even in a smaller region, not just a county, but a region, you start to see challenges to health and nutrition. Not as many fresh foods, not as many healthy or nutritious foods. There tend to be increases in health concerns such as diabetes and proper maintenance of that. And you also see impacts in things like property values and other businesses in the community as well.
Mm-hmm. Right, property values, because this has sort of a knock-on effect, doesn't it? If you're trying to revive or maintain your rural community in Iowa or anywhere else, and you have people interested perhaps in coming for a job, but they see, wait, there isn't even a grocery store in this town of 2,500. That plays into your thinking, doesn't it?
It definitely does. And so when we think about rural development as a whole, it's making sure we have good education and access to health care, jobs for people. But we also have to look at what keeps them in the community, and that's having some basic services like access to food locally.
Mm-hmm. What does this mean, especially for Iowans who rely on food assistance?
It raises additional challenges. One, they may be losing access to places that accept SNAP benefits and other types of food assistance, such as WIC. Or if some of the convenience stores do accept those benefits, which we are seeing more convenience-type stores accept benefits, the choices are much more limited again in terms of healthy and nutritious fresh foods that would help meet those needs. And it's also a significant challenge for seniors in a community, because for both of those kind of populations, those receiving assistance and those of the aging population, transportation can be a big concern as well. And that we don't have public transportation very often in rural communities or any sort of organized transportation. And so access to those opportunities is much more limited as well.
Mm-hmm. There at the Drake Agricultural Law Center, how have you been looking for ways to remedy this, solutions, or at least keep it from slipping further in this direction?
Well, it's not all without hope. We are seeing a lot more discussion coming out about how can we look at both rural development and kind of a holistic picture of what it takes to be successful in building rural communities and looking at it from a different perspective, but also what it takes to rethink our food system as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about making sure that we have, you know, a brick and mortar store with food on the shelves. But for success, we have to figure out how else does that fit in the community? What are the ways within our food supply chain, from producer to the store and all of the steps in between, that we can be more cost effective, more localized, more regional, more direct, whatever it can be, to help maintain successful operations in rural communities, because they don't have the buying power that a lot of the larger stores and chains do. And so cost is a big factor for them. So we're really looking at the food supply chain as a whole, and what can we do to help support new and innovative food supply, food chain innovations along the way. And that can be co-ops. It can be making a store just one part of what the actual grocery store is of a business.
Mm-hmm.
It can be looking at different types of partnerships, or even looking at different types of subsidies and tax breaks and small business association and rural economic development loans that can help encourage a business to get started, but really help maintain and sustain that as well.
Mm-hmm. What about access to food for kids in summers, for instance, when there isn't school?
We are seeing more schools that are opening up different programs. Sometimes within the schools, they may open up either once a day for meals. They may have different types of programs. More and more schools are actually operating food pantries, but it becomes very much a community-based program at this point. And sometimes third parties or nonprofits will step in and operate various programs for kids and sometimes their families as well during the summer to try and help fill that gap.
Mm-hmm. How are we doing in Iowa compared to other states who have similar problems?
Iowa's actually right about the middle, maybe slightly above average in terms of our food insecurity numbers. And food insecurity is basically described as not having access to enough food, healthy, nutritious food for any period of time. And the national average is about 11.8%. And Iowa is very close to that, maybe slightly above. But that jumps in rural communities again. And it really jumps the percentage of households that are food insecure if you look at poverty rates and the impact of lower economic status on issues like food security as well. Mm-hmm. So Iowa is definitely not at the bottom of the pack. We're right in the middle. But there are significant challenges for certain parts of the state and parts of our communities that need more support too.
Across the country or in Iowa especially, are we hearing our elected officials, our policymakers addressing this with solutions, listening to places like the Drake Agricultural Law Center for the analysis and the solutions possibly?
And I think you hear there's definitely interest in and support in trying to resolve these issues. There's just not always agreement in how to do it or how to help fund it. There is more funding, excuse me, coming in for rural development, which is always a benefit. But we have to really look at not just this being a food access issue, not just being a rural development issue, and trying to bridge some of that gap between urban and rural solutions. Because what's going to work in terms of addressing concerns like food deserts and food insecurity in our urban communities is not necessarily going to translate well to our rural communities. Mm-hmm. And we need to look outside the box. And I think you are seeing at least more discussion on this topic in terms of our elected officials and other leaders. But now we just really need to start supporting those activities and not just relying on our nonprofits and our charities like the Food Bank of Iowa and churches and other community members to step in there as well.
Jennifer Swaggerman is the Associate Director of the Drake Agricultural Law Center. Jennifer, thanks for coming into our studio today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming to the end of this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So much big news nationally, of course, with the Mueller report coming out. And as always, Iowa Public Radio on top of the news here in the Midwest and Iowa. We need to groove into the weekend in the worst way, or perhaps in the best way, because we're with Tony Daner, right?
Right.
IPR Studio One Tracks host. Tony, groove us into the weekend. What do you
yes,
got for
you,
us?
You never need a reason to groove into the weekend.
Okay.
I firmly believe that. So let's start with a new one from Nora Jones. She's got a new release out called Begin Again. This is a collection of singles. There's only about seven or eight songs on here. Some co-writes with Jeff Tweedy of Wilco and some other great musicians. Let's hear the title track. This is Nora Jones and Begin Again.
Every thought that I ignore, and all the questions at my door, is when we begin to believe in this again. Can we believe? Can we believe? I walk down the street with shadows at my feet and words in my head, songs left unsaid. Do you know?
Unmistakable tones of Nora Jones, Begin Again. I like that, Tony. Keep going. We need to groove a little bit more, I think.
Yeah, somebody a little closer to home, in fact, right there in your backyard, Ben. This album came out today. Iowa City band, Crystal City. At heart, they're a duo of Sam Drella and Dave Helmer. So there's another great Sam and Dave musical duo
right
out there. And they just put out their new record today. It's called Three Dimensionality. kind of an all-star lineup of Iowa musicians on this album, including the great Dave Zolo. And there's a music video out for this song, and if you want to learn more about it, head over to our website, iowapublicradio.org. Dave talked to me a little bit about the making of this record. But this is Crystal City and the title track from their new record, Three Dimensionality.
Tony Daner of Iowa Public Radio's Studio One. Thanks for grooving us into the weekend.
Anytime, Ben. Thank you.
River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury. Help today from Camus Leeson as well. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. On Monday, Legislative Monday, we'll talk about a bill that would raise the cost of owning solar panels that has divided Iowa legislators. I think plenty of sun in the weekend forecast. Glad to see that. Have a great weekend. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.